glad to see so many people here. We'll have a lot going on the next couple weeks, so welcome back to the academic year. Today we're going to have a talk by Margaret Mills. I know most of you know Margaret, but if you don't, she joined us not too long ago in 1998 from the University of Pennsylvania, where she was chair of the Department of Folklore and Folklife. She's widely regarded as one of the country's leading authorities on Farsi or Persian-speaking world. Her book, and I'm going to get the title right, Rhetorics and Politics in Afghan Traditional Storytelling, in 1993 won the Chicago Folklore Prize for the best academic book of the year in folklore. She has spent a lot of time over the last several decades in Afghanistan and was there again this summer. She and Sally Kitch are doing a project here at Mershon over the next several years, I think, on women and leadership in Afghanistan. So without further ado, Margaret Mills.
Thank you. Thank you all. I actually had sort of expected and hoped that this would be about six people since we didn't start thinking about it till last week. And I will say in candor, this is not really a talk, it's more like a chat. So I hope that we'll devolve into question and answer fairly quickly. Can you all hear me? Should I shout? Okay. I went to Afghanistan I was there for the month of August, which is why the talk is called Afghanistan in August. I was in Herat and Kabul, mostly in Kabul, and for about 8 days in Herat. And my goal there was actually not an analytic project. It was actually to get some other activities going. So I was going around meeting people and specifically recruiting and identifying and to some extent recruiting women who will be participating in a conference that Mershon has very graciously funded for April, which will bring women who are active in reconstruction and conflict mitigation here to OSU. And one of my goals, our goals, Sally and I have been working on this for about 3 years, and as Rich said, we're trying to perhaps move into a larger frame as we go forward. Right now it's about Afghan women. We're trying to get people who have significant sort of on-the-line experience and also an ability to look at the big picture. As with many crisis situations, there's sort of usual suspects. There are the people who are on all the kind of panels and all the AP bulletins and so on. We're trying to get some folks who aren't, and I think we may to some extent have succeeded in getting a little different mix of people, but we'll know more about that later. We can talk about that project in more detail if you like. At any rate, that's slated for April, I think April 15th through the 18th or something, and it's a public event here. So I was recruiting on that. I was also sort of assigned as a mission by some Afghan colleagues who are posted outside of Afghanistan, actually in Tajikistan, to look into the possibility of restarting Afghan ethnographic studies, specifically folklore studies. So it's about expressive culture. There was a fair amount of it going on from the 70s, actually into the 80s, into the Marxist period. There was a fair amount of kind of social research going on in the form of local performance stuff. It was kind of depoliticized in the ways that nationalist folklore efforts often are. That it's okay. Actually, I can quote the Minister of Culture, whom I saw briefly on the question of restarting this thing. This thing being Afghans doing ethnography on Afghans and finding ways to fund them and finding ways to train people, because 30 years of total disruption of the education system have taken their toll on scholarship, as you can imagine. So I went to see Makhdoom Rahim. And said, we want to do this. He said, oh, that's easy. Fine, just get somebody to give you some tape recorders and we'll send some guys out. You'll get some songs. And I said, yeah. You know, and you don't want to offend the guy who's responsible for cultural programming for the whole country. But finally, it was beyond my capacity to restrain myself. And I did say, you know, I've been doing this for a while, and it is my career, and it takes a little more than sending people out with tape recorders. I didn't really want to get into it with him, but for me, the agenda of cultural studies in Afghanistan by Afghans right now is, as most people who want to do it are immediately aware, is extremely political. They're interested in things like oral history. They're interested in the oral traditions of the war. They feel that it's the wars, I should say, plural. They feel that it's very important that the collective memory of their group be preserved. And when you mention the topic, the field of study to people, everyone, of course, has a political position, and it's from their political position that they speak. And they are well aware that it's, yeah, you can, in fact, go out with tape recorders and get songs. Who's singing and what they're singing about is a matter of some sensitivity. And I think that kind of work is, in the minds of many Afghans, crying out to be done. But there's, of course, a lot of other things to do as well. The problem of getting cultural research restarted in the country is one that is acknowledged, and by some people acknowledged passionately, but when you're still trying to get basic health clinics and basic education and things in place, it's not clear when self-reflection by the Afghan community is going to be able to get significant support. That's the other sort of collective agenda item I was working on. The third thing I was doing, which took me to Herat, was a project in the oral history of a family that I've known since 1974. And various members of the family stayed through the war years in Herat. Others, a substantial, the core family, actually were refugees in Iran, in Mashhad, living in the city, not in camps, for about 9 years. So the collective or joint oral history of this family has some layers to it. And I went back this summer to do another layer, specifically to continue the work I'd started last summer with them on the Taliban years and what it had been like in Herat for them. They're a conservative Muslim working class family. There's a huge generational difference, of course, in what people's aspirations are and where they hope to go. And where they didn't get to go because of the war, things like interruption of education. I was just reflecting that the parent generation, the reason I knew them was because the wife was renowned as a storyteller, and I actually did a substantial amount of work with her on her oral storytelling in the 70s before all hell broke loose. And the reason I got to know her at all was coincidentally, or perhaps not coincidentally, her husband was a Peace Corps cook. And I got a note left at a shop where I had been hanging out and schmoozing with the shopkeeper from the Peace Corps guy who was then the employer of my friend's husband. Please come and meet, you know, Mrs. So-and-so. She's a wonderful storyteller. And I thought at the time, all I don't need is somebody speaking to me in Peace Corps patois about fairy tales, you know. So I actually avoided meeting her for a couple of weeks, and then out of courtesy I went. And indeed, she was absolutely fluent in the discourse of folktales, very enthusiastic about it, very enthusiastic about poetry and various other things, and totally unlettered, totally unschooled. So she's an example of someone whose knowledge base was entirely oral, very rich, and quite interpretive. And I ended up working with her a lot, which put me in touch with the family as a family, and that relationship has continued now. So what happened to her and her repertoire in 9 years of displacement and so on and so forth, it's all part of the story. But this summer, the theme of that family actually was marriage and the marriage arrangements and the narratives around the economics and politics of marriage, of which there were three or four going on in their immediate vicinity at the time. So that was the personal research agenda, and as I said, I only had about 8 or 9 days for it, which were very full. And they happened to coincide with the 8 or 9 days when Ismail Khan, the recently deposed warlord, so-called emir of Herat, was having a little fracas with a guy by the name of Aminullah, or Amanullah, depending on who you talk to, who was a partisan of, well, depending on who you talk to, he was either a bandit or a talib or various other things. But coming from Shindan, certainly a Pashtun, and Ismail Khan, as you may know, is a Jamiati, politically speaking, and a Tajik, ethnically speaking. And so there was ethnic and political party goings on. The day I arrived in Herat was also the day that the UN expats were all evacuated for a few days to wait and see what would happen. Nothing much did at that point. The day before I arrived, I believe, the Karzai had sent 500 members of the National Army to occupy the military air base at Shindan, and the Heratis were struck by the fact that what they did was occupy the air base. They really made no attempt to send the guy who had, in the Herati view, attacked Herat home. They just established a ceasefire line, and that was that. And there they sat. So the interpretation during the time I was there, of course, Ismail Khan has since been relieved of his duties as governor and so on. But at the time, the Haradis that I spoke to, who were mostly from this extended family and another extended family with whom I have social comings and goings, just that this was basically the central government moving against Ismail Khan, that the individual who had attacked from the southern area and two other attacks that were actually at that point seemingly controlled by Ismail Khan from the east and from the north, from the area around Chisht and the area around Badis, all those three things happened simultaneously on about August 10th. That two of them had been repulsed. One of them became more of an issue. Ismail Khan actually had an extended public address that he made in the mosque on the Friday. I believe by this time the ceasefire had been declared, but he actually was essentially preaching jihad and saying that you need to defend your homes. These people are not Muslims. They're not acting like Muslims. Therefore, this is a defense of home and religion. And furthermore, I will pay anybody who wants to fight $200 a month. So come get your guns. And there were rumors, there were all kinds of wonderful rumors. Being a folklorist, I was interested in the rumors in particular, that 4,000 guys had come from motorcycles from Mazar to support the Haradis because they figured that Mazar was next and the Pashtuns would be marching on Mazar and so on. A lot of this was put in ethnic terms and also in party terms. The Taliban are coming and so on. So that was, although I didn't plan it that way, it was a moment when I found myself in the middle of the sort of swirling around of opinions and prognostications about what was going to happen. And I think the accurate interpretation, which became a general interpretation after the army arrived, and kept a very low profile, may I say, was that there was no way that Karzai was, as he alleged, unaware of this. This was no surprise. This was, in fact, part of a tactic of removing Ismail Khan from power, and apparently a successful one. And when you consider that Ismail Khan and Dostum, who is the boss, basically, the governor of Mazar, are probably the people with the strongest ground force who were nominally included in the government, or both in various ways nominal appointees of Karzai, that he chose to move against Ismail Khan is very interesting. Herat is or was also the most peaceful part of the country, which means that people there have the largest stake in keeping it that way. So all in all, it was probably a pretty good move on Karzai's part. What's going to happen next is interesting. I understand that the governor who's been appointed in Ismail Khan's place is also a Jamiati and also a Tajik, but not of Ismail Khan's party. It's possible that Alama, who I'm happy to see is here, can give us more details on the actual party alliances of the people involved and more details on that. I'm limited to what I got off a website. So perhaps this is a place to start. I've sort of dumped you into the middle of some of the esoterica of Afghan politics, which of course are not at all available in national press in the United States. For some of you, these things will be familiar. For others, they'll be, you know, Swahili or whatever. But perhaps I should just reiterate the points on which I think I have something to say after a month, and it seemed a very short month. I should also say other things that are not, as far as I know, being reported here include the attitudes of a lot of different people, including NGO expats and Afghans in Kabul, in Herat, that I was able just to query briefly on the election. Are you registered? What do you think? What's going to happen? What do you think should happen? You know, very basic questions like that, just chit-chatty kinds of things. As I said, I was not there to do an analytic process. I was there to contact people for very specific purposes and to talk to friends with some depth. And that the take that I heard, which may have been the one that people thought I would want to hear, is great skepticism about the election. Well, it seems like a lot of trouble. Well, people are getting killed. Well, there's no way this is going to be a free and fair election. Well, why are we spending millions on this when we haven't got X, Y, or Z done yet? This sort of stuff. I did not hear a celebration of the return of or the invention of democratic process in Afghanistan. There are probably those who could give that speech, and in fact, I met some of them. There's people working for an Afghan NGO that is dedicated to the development of civil society. And I hope, is Craig here? Craig Jenkins? No. His colleague and ex-student, Susan Schmeidel, who works for Swiss Peace, has been closely involved with them with that NGO's work. And I understand that she may be invited to give a talk here. I think that would be a very good thing if we can round her up, because she has another perspective on all this, which is the more forward Afghan effort on behalf of development of institutions for civil society, especially sort of grassroots democracy, democratization at the village level, and so on. Those folks have quite a bit to say about that, and so I would not want to take the opinions of cab drivers and my personal friends and various NGOs who have other projects, including health and education and so on, as indicative of what the country thinks. And what the country thinks in Afghanistan, I think, is an absolutely unsupportable rubric, because all kinds of thinking is going on. I should perhaps talk a little bit about the dynamic of recruitment, because of recruitment of the people that we're trying to bring to this conference, because I think it's indicative of a larger pattern. Basically, what I was doing was doing a kind of a snowballing network exercise, where I would go to meet a woman, either Afghan or not, who is involved in a visible program of some kind, a reconstruction or conflict mitigation kind of thing. And I would go to her, and I would ask her to discuss her work. I would explain that we're trying to organize this conference, and I would ask her who else she thought was doing significant work in this area, names of people, names of organizations, and so on, and I would take that information down. And I did this with as many people as I could reach, which were probably 8 or 10 different representatives of different institutions over a 10 or 12-day period, including some state agencies and mostly NGOs. And what I came to expect, frustratingly, was that I would go and I would get a list of names, and they were people, and I would say, we're not looking for the usual suspects. We're looking for people who've been doing significant work here but may not be that well known outside of Afghanistan, but who could represent an aspect of this process and would want to do so. So that was sort of the agenda. And so I would get a list of names, and then I would go to the next person, and I would say, who do you recommend? And I'd get another list of names. And then I'd go through the names that I already had and say, what do you think about so-and-so, so-and-so, and so-and-so? I was looking for overlaps, you know, for multiple recommendations of similar names or similar agencies. And what I would tend to get was a discreditization of the other list. Oh, no, they're not doing anything. Oh, no, she's all talk. Da-da-da-da-da. You know, so there's a lot of competition for resources. There's competition for opinions and for authority to have opinions. And it's hard, even though I managed to contact two different organizations where Afghan women active in or leading NGOs work together. One is the Afghan Women's Network, which is a cluster of 40 Afghan-run women's NGOs doing different kinds of projects, who formed themselves into a kind of a democratically organized professional umbrella group. And the other is an Afghan Women's Political Network, which is a very informal group that simply meets, I think, biweekly to discuss political issues of significance to these women. It's not, I don't think, even a formal membership organization. So it has a conversation going that's fairly open forum and, you know, as open as things get, where opinions run high. From the Afghan Women's Political Network, I also was able to circulate a call for proposals for this conference and got an interesting range of participation. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to work with them at length and winkle out more proposals. I got 4 out of a group of about 12 or 15 people who were there who felt able to present in this kind of setting. And they ran the gamut politically, from an old lefty whose rhetoric was really, really not reconstructed, kind of 1982, basically, I think she's probably a Parchami Marxist who wants to do village collectives and things like that. And I said, do you think the word collective has any difficulties for Afghans these days? And she said, oh, no. And, oh, well, as a matter of fact, it's poison. But in many circles. But at any rate, so she has her own discourse and her own agenda, and her agenda is probably pretty wholesome, but her discourse is going to kill her, and in fact has put her in danger. She was imprisoned by the Falkis for a couple of years when the Parchamis and the Halkis were having at it in the early 80s and so on. So she has had a serious experience, a serious history. She's not a trivial person, but her discourse is such that I don't think she's going to get a serious hearing right now in Afghanistan. And so on, over to people who are less discursively committed but are committed to different particular activities, mostly health and education. And the conversations that you're able to have when you're taking taxis and you speak Persian in such a way that people aren't immediately aware that you're an American. I have enough weird dialect features in my Persian that people don't say, oh, you know, you must have learned that in Washington, D.C. or whatever. Generally, people ask me where I'm from, and if I think it's useful, I tell them. And there were a lot of conversations of that sort with shopkeepers, with, you know, as I said, cab drivers. There's an amazing range of people driving cab in Kabul for the usual reason, because, you know, the professional salary is between $10 and $40 a month, $40 for a minister. So, you know, there's a lot of secondary kinds of economies going on, and the folks you meet driving cabs run the gamut from people who have a leftist history and can't get a job at all to one guy who's a geology professor at the university who's been at a conference in Germany and was hopeful of more study abroad to enhance his skills and so on and so forth. So it's a real range of folks. And everybody that I met talked some kind of politics. I think it's fair to say that they talked what they thought I was capable of understanding and what they thought I should hear. So, you know, what that is relative to what they think is a completely indeterminate relationship. But I guess I hope I've been somewhat provocative or evocative, because what I'd like to do is ask you to give me some of, you know, the framework of your questions. Maybe there's more that you would want to know from wherever you're coming from. And I really didn't want to make this a monologue. It's not an analytic discourse at all. It's like, I was there. Is there anything I might know that you might want to hear? Yeah, Don.
What were their expectations of you?
Mixed, I think. I think when, given my Persian and given the way I was dressed, which was modestly but not in a burqa, the assumption was that I knew my way around, and the assumption was that I had some connections. So the question was, what kind of resources has she got? Which is a very fair question in that environment. I think any sane person would ask it. And also, who the hell is she? You know? And so, and she's an old woman with gray hair, so probably she's not that important, but she might be. You know? So you got to figure that out.
Did they have suspicion of your
political agenda, or was it other? Yeah, I mean, anybody with no suspicion is either comatose or soon to be dead. You know what I mean? I think everybody's sizing everybody up politically. And that just goes with the territory. And so you say what you say, and they interpret it the best they can. I think there's very little political naivete there. But, you know, a lot of political positioning, different kinds of positions.
Yeah. I asked a really broad question. I'll give a really long answer. What's left of the Afghanistan you experienced in the 70s?
Oh, boy. I think you have to get out of Kabul. Kabul's essentially, socially, according to returned Kabulis, unrecognizable. I think the people with the worst culture shock there are people who remember it before the war and are now going back. Things like basic security, architecture. There's a building boom going on. If you think the McMansions out in Delaware County are bad, you should see what's going on in Kabul. I mean, it's amazing. It's some kind of black money, I'm sure drug money, a lot of it, and other kinds of fallout from the reconstruction process, most of which is falling out. I'm sorry I didn't get photos. This was a serious lapse on my part. I'm going to have to go back, because these things are popping up like mushrooms on every street corner in the new city and in adjacent districts of Kabul. And your basic structure is about a three-story, this is domestic architecture, mind you, three-story with a big arch over the front, an open kind of set of verandas, you know, series of verandas, the open part where you could sit out on the veranda and look up and down the street, generally speaking, has mirror tile over the top of it, and particularly popular is a little lozenge at the top that says in mirror tile, mashallah, you know, thank God for me. And the other thing is, of course, these things rear way up over the usual privacy walls, which are generally speaking 8 to 12 feet tall. And what they've got is one-way glass. There is a land office business in one-way glass in Kabul right now. And, of course, these things are in no way earthquake protected. So it's going to be Pancake City the first time it's reasonable. And this is also true of the professional architecture, which is going up as, you know, some very monumental glass-faced constructions. most 5 to 7 stories, but some taller. There's one famous project that apparently was started during the Taliban period is now being finished in one of the major intersections of the new city. That is a, it looks like it belongs in Dubai. It probably does. It's a totally sealed, climate-controlled, reflective glass-faced kind of L-shaped building, and I think 7 floors. I think it's topped out now, and it looks like it's 7 or 8. The thing about climate-controlled buildings in Kabul is that there's only electricity from dusk to dawn at this point. So how they're going to run their air conditioning, presumably with very expensive generators. Air pollution is a major, major problem, both from car exhaust and from everything else, because people have to run generators if they want to have juice during the day. Kabul, I'm not sure how Mazar is. Herat actually has better electricity than Kabul. Ismail Khan was buying it from Iran and also, I understand, from Turkmenistan. So in terms of physical infrastructure, it's pretty disastrous. These construction projects generally encroach on roads. People who've built either these private McMansions or other kinds of structures that feel they need security are just putting concrete bunkers out into the nearest lane of a road. So a road that had been a 4-lane road is now a 1.5-lane road or a 2-lane road because there's construction materials on one side and bunkers on the other. So there's no control. The city planning people have apparently no control over the impact of development on the city. Gridlock is normal, at least twice a day in the parts of the city where I moved, which were basically from the new city down into the central market area. There are buses. India donated a bunch of good, big diesel buses, so there's a new bus service there, which is pretty good. This is where all old Corolla station wagons go to die, by the way. Every other car there is an aging Corolla station wagon because you can't kill them. And cabs are probably half the vehicles in, well, a third of the vehicles in Kabul are probably cabs. And 90% of those are Corolla station wagons. So, there's certain practicality going on here. People are getting on with their lives. And then there's an enormous economic discrepancy between the people who are working in some kind of local hire capacity and the people who have one way or another overseas salaries. I mean, the discrepancy between a good domestic salary, which would be a real good one, would be, say, $600 a month. I mean, that's really good money. And a basic expat salary, which would be $10,000 a month, something like that. So you can imagine the kind of what that does, you know, what that kind of economic environment. And it's not the only place this is true, obviously, but it's particularly obvious there and particularly discussed. So Kabul, pre-war Kabul, or even Marxist period Kabul, is socially, I think, gone, finished. And what you do, how you go from this kind of looting mentality, which is what's there now, to any kind of normal economy, I would like to know. I mean, if anybody here knows how you make a transition from disaster to post-disaster economically in this particular form,
yeah.
I would love
to. Although Gaidar, actually, the Russian, he's a great attempt. He was involved in providing the American public on
Iraq.
What's the morale of the women there? I mean, if they
morale of the women? I have a message for you from the women of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Get off the burqa. It doesn't matter. We can do what we want to do with this thing over our heads, and we are doing so.
Right. No, and I.
So that's there's that much. But what they can do? No, I'm not addressing you personally. But that's what people were saying: is just tell them to get over it. You know, because we can work with that. That's not our problem. But there are serious problems of credibility, of professional women trying to work up into the power structure, which is male. There's a huge shortage of teachers, but teachers are not adequately paid. There's a lot of women resuming their training after having done various informal economic, especially informal teachings. The secret schools deal that was made such a thing of in the Taliban period, I mean, various people claimed to be heroically running secret schools. I think anybody who wanted to could run a domestic school and thus get a minor amount of income, which they all badly needed. So women I talked to about running clandestine schools, this was more, not this summer, but the previous summer, were saying, they would say, yeah, of course, you know, if you had education and you were willing to do that, you did it. It was a little bit dangerous. People would notice, and you had to make sure they didn't notice by having the girls arrive at different times or pretend they were going to the hammam or something and carrying bath equipment or whatever. You know, there were various ways to make your passage through the streets not too obvious. And some people were shut down, were warned, and decided to stop because they were warned. This was during the Taliban period. And I asked them, so, you know, what, you know, this was really a dangerous thing to do. Why did you do it? And or if it was dangerous, why did you do it? And they said, well, a couple of reasons. You know, it's our national duty, it's our religious duty, and or I needed the money. And all those motivations were there, and there was a whole lot of informal schooling being done by women. So they moved from that informal mentality, and this was in the two cities I've been in, are Herat and Kabul. In the villages, there's really nobody there to do this. So if there was teaching going on, it was the local mullah, probably, or perhaps a returned school-going man, but very unlikely to have been a woman teaching in the village. So the question of how you work out from the city presence of educated or partly educated women, how you get their abilities addressed to rural needs, is a huge disconnect. And it's not for lack of wanting to do so, but the mobility of women outside of the protective zone of their family is really limited. So their ability to go be professionals elsewhere and go do what they want to do is not what they would wish. So they do feel constrained, but they don't feel constrained by the burqa. In fact, the burqa is a mechanism of mobility in the present circumstances. And they would say it's interesting. The story I got on the burqa was, I said, so, you know, what do you do? And they said, well, we need it for security purposes. And I said, really, what kind of security purposes? They said, well, you know, beautiful women are being snatched all the time, and if you've got a burqa over your head, nobody knows you're beautiful. So there's a sense that women are being trafficked, which is true. There's a sense that families are vulnerable to kidnapping for political reasons, which is probably also true. And there's also the fact that I was talking to some woman who looked about like me and was unlikely to get snatched for her looks, you know, so who was doing the burqa wearing? Everybody. And I think it's a question of claiming space and claiming, and you know, the unknownness of it, the fact that people aren't sure who's under there is a resource in a situation where people are under surveillance and there's a lot of competition going on for various kinds of things. So although they alluded to the vulnerability of young, beautiful women, which is a whole cultural theme we could go on about, the older professional women were also using the burqa as a way of limiting their vulnerability to various kinds of social pressure in order to go out and do stuff, specifically organizing stuff and interventions of various kinds. Does that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not so much the headdress that I'm concerned with, because that's in a lot of the Eastern countries. And, you know, it's just that, you know, are you stuck being teachers, nurses?
Yes.
Do you become business women?
There is a women's business association, which was about to merge with the Chamber of Commerce when I left. They were just talking about taking themselves over to become part of the Chamber of Commerce, whether in Kabul. Whether that's good news or bad news, I don't know. I didn't get to meet them directly, but we may be able to recruit someone from that organization to come here. So there is such a thing. And there's also, as I understand it, the American Embassy just now has been trying to recruit Afghan women to come to entrepreneurial, some Afghan women, it's a small program, to come to an entrepreneurial training program in the United States. So there is something about private entrepreneurship, but I'm not sure how much. Yeah?
I'm curious about what your goals are for the conference in April. Is it for cross-pollination of ideas among the women and NGOs within Afghanistan, or
That's good. That's a good question. I think the cross-pollination amongst themselves, which is necessary, is much more efficiently and potently done there. And that's one of the bits of advice we got when we were going around, you know, marketing this activity. I really think that what we're doing at this point, and Sally has opinions about this too, which she's very good at articulating, I think what we're doing here is to try to get information out here for various kinds of use. I think the people that we're inviting to this conference may profit by direct exposure to American opinions and the American political climate, several of them have not been exposed to it directly before, except through expats. So they'll get some value from operating in an American ideological environment. But the main value, as I see it, is for this group, for this conference group, is for us to take their consultation on what's going on with them, what works for them, what doesn't work for them, what makes sense to them that we're doing, what does not, and so on and so forth, and have that happen here. Because all this information would be more efficiently gathered there. But the point is, who's listening? So we're hoping to bring it here to an audience that would definitely listen and try to expand that audience as much as we can. But Sally, do you want to speak to that?
Well, it's also a lot of context for you. And that is sort of represented by doing Resolution 13.
Do you want to come to the mic? I don't think they can hear you. The acoustics here are really terrible.
If I just stand. The UN Resolution 1325, which mandated that all member states of the United Nations actually involve women in peacemaking, peacekeeping, conflict resolution, and social reconstruction in conflict zones around the world. And that resolution is relatively new, 2002, but it really hasn't ever been enacted. And we're monitoring the progress via various means to see if anybody's going to take it seriously. So we decided to take it seriously. And we decided to make Afghanistan sort of a test case. And so just as the women coming here will be new data points for us, because they will bring us information that we can't get. I mean, just the questions that we're inspired to ask here at this session indicate how little we really know about what goes on in Afghanistan. So that's very important. But also to help them put their activities and their goals and their future planning into the context of this global move to involve women in, you know, international security issues, that's a large part of our motivation.
Yeah, and we should say that we have a crypto agenda here, especially if there's any large donors in the audience who'd like to know about it. Because what we would like to do next, if there is a next, is to establish at OSU a think tank for women from conflict zones, from different zones, so that we could bring a small group of people each year, and maybe six or eight, from different places to actually consult with one another here with our colleagues. We did a sort of an interest assessment recruitment last year. We turned up about 30 faculty, some of whom I see here. Thank you very much for coming, who are interested in collaborating on this project. We're still looking for money, and that is a major, major problem. Everybody says, this is wonderful, this is virtuous, this is terrific. It's not our program. So we're trying to figure out whose program it is. Yeah. Talk of Iraq and Afghanistan? Yeah, the short take on that is, what the hell are you doing in Iraq when you haven't fixed us yet? That's the basic form it takes. And with probing, people are tactful, you know, so they wouldn't say, you guys hate Muslims. But there is, expressed to me by people who know me well, the understanding or the assumption that America really has it in for the Islamic world, and that they're doing Afghanistan because they know they need it for security purposes, but they're not doing it right. And the proof of their having it in for Muslims is the Iraq war and the fact that they're doing nothing about Palestine-Israel. So that's understood. It's also pretty well understood there that Karzai is an American attachment and would not survive without Khalilzad. And so all those things are there. I mean, there is a sense of global issues. There's a sense that we owed Afghanistan for ending the Soviet Union. That's a common feeling there. And that that our obligation was to fix the place, basically to do the Marshall Plan in 1990 instead of not doing it now. And that we didn't do so, and so we reaped the whirlwind. But that we've perversely decided that it's because of Muslims, and so now we're punishing Muslims. So that's kind of the very, you know, cartoonish version of the thinking that won't be told to you directly unless people decide that you can hear it. And only very few people would actually say anything that rude to me, but a few of them did.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Oh, yes. And that has also to do with the kinds of interventions, and this goes right back to the Soviet period of the war, the kinds of interventions that the respective national help and reconstruction groups did, the styles of intervention, the kinds of employment of Afghan nationals in international organizations and so on. Yeah, I would say, I mean, this again may be somewhat exacerbated by my own attitudes too, you know, that I tend to read into this, but yes, I would say that different nationalities are perceived quite differently in the cities. I'm not sure about the village impact, because in villages people haven't seen that wide a variety of folks. They may have formed some opinions as camp residents in Pakistan, where there was a wide variety of international intervention. Those who were in Pakistan, a huge number were in Iran, where the international intervention picture was very different. So there's an experiential base there that would give you, you know, a sense of nuance. There's also the fact that different nationalities, or different national efforts, are actually involved in different sectors. They sort of divvied up the sectors. So, well, there's a long story there, but yeah, the short answer is I believe so. I wouldn't be ready to precisely characterize it, but yes, I do think there's a difference of perception. And ISAF, of course, they've been begging for, various people have been begging for the extension of ISAF security outside of Kabul. They're not begging for more Americans chasing Taliban too much, but they are begging for enhancement, for support of security. I do hear a lot of talk about training the army, which we're also alleged to be doing, and training police. I gather that Germans have been involved with training Afghan police forces, but I'm not sure what state that's in. So security, I mean, the other thing that is to be heard on every street corner is just give us security and we'll sort the rest. You know, just help us stop the basic physical insecurity and we'll get on with it. And that, in fact, that's not happening. So from that point of view, European intervention on the security front is also seen as inadequate. And, you know, but it's different.
Yeah, two questions. One, would you spend a little bit more on that in the sense of personal security? People feel reasonably comfortable walking the streets or they're constantly on edge. And the other question about the Taliban. People look back at that as sort of a dead letter. Is there some nostalgia for that period?
Oh, sure. Both. It depends who you talk to. And depends who you are, how secure you feel. Expats are periodically warned not to hang out, especially not in certain areas where expats are, you know, expected to hang out, certain parts of the city where there's things that expats might want to go and do. Afghans, people were getting on with their lives. They didn't have much choice. And there weren't as many. There was a kind of a lull in attacks in Kabul during the time I was there. People noticed the lull and said, hey, there's a lull, which meant that there wasn't, you know, a car bomb every month or something. There was 6 or 8 weeks there when there weren't any. And I'm not sure how many attacks are unreported, so I'm not sure what the general street. But people were not scurrying, you know, it wasn't like Beirut. They weren't just scurrying for fear.
That's what car bombs
is, ordinary crime. Oh, ordinary crime. People are very, nobody leaves their house unattended, for instance. There's a lot of break-ins and stuff like that. So you don't ever, nobody, even, I mean, it doesn't matter how poor you are, you don't leave your house empty. And so that, the assumption is that security, there was a, in fact, in Herat, to shift from Kabul, there was a story that I must have been told 6 or 8 times in my 8 days there about a family that was upper middle class and rather wealthy people, a man and I believe 2 of his sons, who were killed by thieves who entered their home and they heard noise in the compound. This is a walled compound with a house in the middle, so there's a garden around. And I guess the father, one of the sons went out having heard noises in the compound and didn't come back. So then a father and another son went out and they were both killed. And there's enough, I think their throats were cut actually, but there's enough, you know, people firing guns every so often and stuff that you would hear a gun close up and you wouldn't necessarily know if it was in your compound or the next compound or wherever. But anyway, so this was very notorious that these 3 people were killed. And as a matter of fact, one of the thieves apparently tripped and fell down the well trying to leave, and so was captured. And his trial and his his confession, which I'm sure was under extreme duress, were gossiped about very widely. So the security that there isn't has a high profile. But there's also, I think Herat, one of the reasons this story was so much repeated in Herat was that the basic street security in Herat was a lot better than it was in Kabul, as with other amenities. But whether that's going to continue remains to be seen, because one of the reasons there were more amenities in Herat was that Ismail Khan was keeping much of the revenue from the over the national border customs trade, allegedly about $1 million a day, $1 million to $1.2 million a day. And he was spending a small percentage of that on city amenities and sending some proportion of it to Karzai, but not nearly. You know, it was not a federal tax that was being remitted to Herat. It was the reverse. So the fact that they had resources there that Kabul didn't have, it's a much smaller place, and they had a lot more, you know, money for him to just apply. And security was regarded as pretty good there by those people. But they were saying, you don't go to the villages anymore. Last year I went out visited the village of one of my friends, but this year they say we don't dare go see our relatives. So the sense was that the security perimeter in Herat was shrinking pretty dramatically. They were, again, there was a lot of talk about it, so I'm assuming there's fairly high anxiety.
You mentioned our ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad. I'm wondering whether you could say more about how he's understood or regarded in Afghanistan. If I understand it, his family, who lived there until 78, has his family come back with him? Have they settled where they were? Is he an ethnic figure in any way, or is he affiliated with any particular faction within Afghanistan?
Well, ethnically, he's Pashtun, and he's affiliated with Bush and with Karzai. I mean, it's more that Karzai is affiliated with him. I don't know. It's possible, again, that Alam could give us more on that. I didn't hear Khalilzad discussed at all, but I didn't ask. I mean, I was basically wanting to know what people were willing to tell me, you know, so I didn't go around saying, how's our ambassador doing? So, nor would I particularly trust what I heard if I had done that. But he was not a name to gossip upon, particularly. So I can't give you much. I probably wasn't moving in the circles where he is a name to gossip on. In fact, I can say that it was damned hard to get an appointment with our embassy. The embassy is a bunker, and the people who are there do not go out. They're, in fact, totally restricted. The Marines who are posted there, they're about to replace. Actually, Sherpas are doing security duty on our embassy now. But the Marines who have been posted there are basically combat soldiers, and they're not happy, and they are tired of being locked up. They're there, and they don't have access to a cold beer for their entire posting. So you can imagine how well they're doing culturally. But and they're all, you know, 19 to 25 years old. So the embassy culture is one of the things that's unrecognizable from the old days. One of the things that we were reflecting on was that Ted Elliott, who was the ambassador when I was there in the mid-70s,
who?
Ted Elliott, Theodore Elliott, who then went and taught at Tufts and diplomacy school, a friend of his came to town, so they got themselves into their travel all or whatever they had at that point, and they went off to Badakhshan, you know, the ambassador driving. Well, you know, that ain't going to happen for a long time. I mean, Karzai went out to campaign for the presidency and apparently got his helicopter rocketed a few days ago. So, you know, it's just the interactive culture of the embassy with the rest of the universe is really, really drastically different. So it's probably no accident that Khalilzad is not much talked about. He's in the newspaper a lot. So, you know,
doing what? They're
reporting that he had this meeting or that conversation or blah, 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 you know. Again, I didn't do a systematic reading of the newspapers. I was, you know, sort of plugging along occasionally, but he's certainly there when he comes and goes and, you know, who he met with, stuff like that.
Are you willing to see that the president's plane gets a rocket shot at him? Are they afraid to go from Herat village? Who do they think is going to attack them? Is there much conversation of any kind of unified groups that are opposed to the government and threaten them, or are these just fears of an individual gangster who might be out?
I think that really depends where you are. I think there are sectors that are controlled by known opposition groups, and that's who you fear when you go there. But there are zones where there just isn't security, so it's basically anybody who's you know, ready to do something. And of course, when somebody, there's also quite a bit of conspiracy theory around. So for instance, the attack from Shindan, I asked, so who is this guy? You know, and they say, oh, well, he's a Taliban. He's a Taliban. Or, well, he's just a bandit. Or, you know, he's a Shindani who's got a personal grudge against Ismail Khan's family. You know, so the interpretations of who's doing what really vary, and I think some of it represents politics on that particular piece of ground, but there's also just a sense that without firm security, there will be opportunistic violence pretty much anywhere.
So if security were to be improved by more defensive Karzai regime, would it be seen as sort of simply legitimating an illegitimate regime? The security is going to come in behind the regime.
Yeah.
At the same time that you said a little earlier, just give us the security.
Yeah. I think that there's a couple of test cases for that. That's a really interesting way to look at it. I'm wondering what's happening next in Herat, because people who didn't like Ismail Khan's politics were saying at least he gave us security. And so if the next regime, assigned by Karzai, delivers the security, that'll be the test, whether there is a regional... You know, whether there's a regional separatist politics there that really cuts, or whether it's all about getting on with their lives, as they say it is. That's Herat, though. I'm not sure how it would be in Mazar, where two local guys have been squaring off against each other ever since after 9/11, and well before that, in fact, whether things would be so easily, you know, moved into, well, just give us security. I don't know, because there's a question behind that, too, is that who's paying off whom? You know, how much of the politics really is personal rivalry, personal factionalism, or party rivalry, party factionalism, and how much of it is delivering the goods? Another thing that has to be factored in here, of course, is drugs and the environment in which the drug economy can best continue, because it's, I think, by some estimations, actually larger in dollar amounts than the Reconstruction economy. It's on that order. So the whole question of what constitutes security and who gets credit for it, I think you have to factor in this enormous heroin trade and the fact that the people who are doing it need certain conditions in order to do it, which may well be security from their point of view, whether they have... As near as I can tell, the drug people are not alleged to have an ideological attachment. They're the drug guys, and they're not seen as, you know, belonging to any particular political stripe. So that, I think that's an enormous factor, and it's not one that we're hearing about. As you probably know, some of the people that have been allies to the American effort in the South are also deeply involved with the drug economy. So the ability to really interdict drugs is our ability to do that is pretty compromised still.
I'm curious. I heard about the United Nations and some of them that included the mission of the United in the labor of the student. I was wondering whether you were familiar with that effort, whether the women that you
in the UN interventions?
Yeah, well, in the UN, the labor cafe is in contact with several members of the parents in Afghanistan. So whether they were involved, what they thought about it, and just in general, what you think the developments of the situation in Afghanistan would have been had the
Could we not intervene?
Whether there was any sense that
Well, my sense of the trajectory is that, first of all, I'm sorry, I don't know. I think that question needs to be answered by the oral history process, actually by direct interviews with women who were affected by those interventions. And that would be a question of asking around until you found out people who had those particular memories and wanted to discuss them. The problem of what would have happened if, you know, if we hadn't intervened is hard for me, as a counterfactual, that's hard for me to entertain, because it seems to me that the events leading up to 9/11, including the destruction of the Bamiyan Buddhas, including the expulsion of various NGOs, including the NGOs that were working with women, the ever more dramatic marginalization of the programs for women, which, on the other hand, there was that was sort of formally out there. Informally, there are alleged to be Taliban who were actually supportive of interventions for women, at least on health, if not on education grounds. So there's this, well, he wasn't such a bad guy anyway, we could actually work with him. Some of that history comes out with talking with NGOs who worked through the Taliban period. And I didn't do that systematically, but I know there are those who said we could deal. You know, there were people we could deal with, individuals. But I think at the larger scale or in the general kind of public perception, and with the killing of Massoud, which was 2 days before 9/11, that the people who were then in charge, and I think that's largely Al-Qaeda and company, were pretty well set on precipitating. We were not going toward an accommodation or toward an isolation of Afghanistan that would have resulted in a reduction of oppressive measures. The oppressive measures would have been cranked up to the extent that they were seen as a provocation, that they were effective as provocation, I should say. So I think what we could have expected was further provocation. If, you know, for instance, for counter-factuals, if they'd missed the World Trade Center, you know, somehow, I think that other provocations would have ensued. The ones there are pretty mild compared to that, but I think you can draw a line between those points. And what we were looking at was a concerted attempt to precipitate an international conflagration of some kind. So I can't say what would have happened if 9/11, you know, if we had not been provoked.
Perhaps one o'clock by some time, and I can see people are starting to drift out. So before we have many more, I want to have everyone thank Margaret.
Thank you.
For those of you still here, there are two people I for sure I should have introduced right away, and I forgot. One is Brett Kubicek, who's visiting this year as a postdoc. If you haven't got a chance to meet Brett yet, please do. The other is Maria Gatha, who's visiting this year as a pre-doc from Minnesota. You work with Catherine Sickert among others, and so Shill is here as well. I'm sure there's some others who should be introduced, but for those of you who don't know these two from outside OSU, I wanted to point them out so you can introduce yourself. Next Thursday at lunchtime, we're hosting Joe Stiglitz. He won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2001. He's written a book a couple years ago called Globalization and Its Discontents, and he has a more recent book out right now. He's going to talk on whether the new millennium has made new economic laws needed or something to that effect. But we're going to do it in the grand ballroom of the faculty club so the crowd can be slightly bigger. And we'll do it in conjunction with the Department of Economics. Julie is keeping a list. You'll need to let her know if you'd like to come so we can have some sense of how many people we can do for this lunch. So that's a week from Thursday. Thank you very much. Thank you again, Margaret.
Yes, I do.
Is the conference, do you know yet? I think I have a Traffic jam.
I know, it's not like it's just
Well, my window faces on the meal.
Okay. So if I go.
There's a lot of that.
I mean, you're going to come in. Yeah.
Yeah.
I
can go
down. Okay. Okay. And when I can, yes. I mean, maybe I'll put that in.
Yeah, but then you have to do it by contact. Okay. She wasn't bad.
Okay. Or, I mean, yeah. If you want to be the one that's more.
No, that was it.
connection to it.
I've never seen the office up there.
Okay, it's down on this office.
It's weird because it's left as well. Okay. And you can let me know since both of you want to sit there. You know how it's set up. Because there's not two computers, so we
I can always give you the name of the woman
that I use as a travel agency and have a conversation with her to see, you know, how much she can absolutely how much she can do. And then once an itinerary is worked out, then the information needs to get to me with the itinerary information. It says do the paperwork to get the ticket, and I get the ticket. So, you know, but I think for conferences sometimes it's easier with less people communicating, you know, with maybe a central person. Are you going to have any honorariums on this thing?
Yeah, there's some modest honorariums.
Okay. Well, I'll say this about that. I doubt that we have any kind of tax agreement with Afghanistan, and it's probably 30%
would be small. So it's, it shouldn't be that.
Okay. Okay, so you All right, well, I'm confused then. A per diem would be, then you would have, you know, if we were to give them a Columbus per diem, what are you talking about?
Columbus per diem, exclusive of housing to all the rates and all.
But per diem, is really, for meals, is $43. And $43, we have to take out the meals that they have at the conference. I can't give them per diem and have them be fed by the conference. I mean, that's what per diem is.
Well, you call it an honorarium, and then they get
right, and it's 30% taken out. And it's 30% taken out from our end because we don't have a tax. I'm sure we don't have a tax agreement. We didn't have a tax agreement with Denmark. And they don't have a social security number. Your people will not. And, you know, this and that and the other kind of thing. So, you may want to get with Linda.
Sure. How about a scholarship?
And brainstorm what is above board and meets all of your needs. But I would get with Linda on this to be thinking about this to see what will work to get this handled. But per diem, calling it a per diem when you're getting fed 3 meals a day.
Well, I know all of these things with this
absolutely. I mean, I don't know why we can't.
Well, that
come up
sounds
with
right to me. I mean, I can imagine.
Well, they do, and they do. I mean, you know, we do as people that put the paper over through because we got audited last year. You know, and I think Ohio State is getting blamed a little bit. And the Dispatch, I know, is called and wants some records, you know, at the public university and wants some information, and so they're tightening up, so we're pretty careful here ourselves as well goes through. But I'm sure she can, you know,
what's possible.
Absolutely. But like I said, the honorarium. Now, I'll tell you one thing that comes to mind. If you pay them, I'm just trying to think, and I'm going to have to check on that, for writing the paper. Are they going to write papers?
Well, that was our
you know, writing a paper, and the work is not done in the United States.
Yeah.
So we don't involve us at all.
That's good.
Okay.
That was our original thing, was
reading
the papers and write papers.
Yeah. Not done in U.S. Check them on.
Thank you.
Which is better to get back to?
On this kind of stuff, yeah. Okay. Before we go into other issues and
stories, I'm also thinking about split between the airfare issue and the meal book issue. How are we going to run the paperwork through for paying for their meal?
I don't know. What happened? We really have to bring Linda in on some of these things. I have not had a conference where I've had to do visas. I've done a lot of conferences, but I haven't done visas.
But that can be done through, I think, the emergency mechanism of the people to transfer them to, or using the beginning to secure the control.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you can have a central person of your aid that some money can go to and they can dish it out.
Actually, we're going to use it to
do that.
That makes sense.
Yeah. But once again, some of these key issues, it'd be good sooner than later to get with Linda to get your heads around, you know, what to do when you get the ball rolling. Because this is.
She may have some.
Oh, absolutely. We just had conference in Turkey, and you know, we had some money where it was just a bunch was given to them, and they did this and that. I didn't have any part to do with it, but she has experience with all of the conferences on the fiscal end. And, part of what I do is just to certainly do all the reimbursement when that comes in after the fact.
We send our
I mean, you can do it however you want. You can get it to you and then send it to me.
You're the Marshawn.
Right. So Dick Dunder had a conference in South Africa, and he wanted all the people to send reimbursements to. So he could look up. He's very particular, so that he could look at them and approve that there weren't any wayward charges on there. I can make up a nice I have a fairly template for a reimbursement form that has the information that I need, and then I can tweak it towards your particular conference, and that can go in a folder that you might provide to these people, and that kind of thing, and we'll take a look at that. And, do the pre-travel paperwork that needs to get over to travel. Decide on the payments if I'm involved with that, figure that out.
What about preparation of conference material? Did we get work for that?
In terms of what?
Well, if we wanted to have packets agenda and stuff that we would
if you have a paid person, it generally falls on that side. Generally it does. Once again, I'm going to have knee surgery, and it's going to take me out for 6 weeks. I haven't, because I have an orthopedist that I'm not sure we're going to see each other. Arrogant. I know, but
that's the mobile personality. It's my mom.
What's the deal with them?
They're just thugs.
I've dealt with two of them who are over the top. So much that you're just
trying to.
But you know what? This guy is the head over there, and they have you between a rock and a hard place.
My dad used to say, well, there are the guys who really want to take me a hacksaw and saw him off your leg, but they have to prove. I don't know. It's not true.
But the guy doesn't save lives. He makes people feel better. I'm sorry. He doesn't save children's lives. He doesn't go to burning buildings. And he told me, because I've been bitching about waiting for an hour and a half, because I really do mind that. He told me I have to have my patients understand what it takes for me to see them. Quote unquote. Wait a minute. He said, because, my practice costs go on. I said, I know. He goes, no, you don't.
That's really common.
Remember what he did tell me, he was world renowned. But he is world renowned, so I made sure that was thrown in there.
This is
stupid. Oh, and then he told me, I have paid the ultimate price.
The ultimate price?
I paid the ultimate price. Well, check the, I get up at 4 and I get home at 8. I want to say, listen to some of the bitch. Go tell that to somebody who's lost their kids over, you know, or whatever. You've got a home in Dublin or somewhere to go to.
You don't need to see
but I've got to have my nieces done and these guys. What the hell do I do? Well, I don't, you know.
Did he know that you were not being alone?
Oh, yeah, he wrote a letter to my other doctor. But I talked to you, and he recommended me to 2 other people.
Oh, good.
So but I don't want to see somebody else.
Oh, you want to work?
I want a good person to do my knees, because I have to have them both done.
Yeah, but
he's... I swear to God, I paid the ultimate price. I got you some
You're
not
buying that. I don't
want somebody to be mad at me. Well, you know, and I wanted to see, you know, I just thought, you know, for being upset, why can't I say I don't like to wait an hour and a half? Why can't I say that? You know what, you can't. And you're just,
he's a controlling son of a bitch, and he has to work for anybody else in the room. I think that's a bad sign in the doctor.
Well, you couldn't fall down on your knees.
You know, I wanted to say, let me go back out in the waiting room, build a shrine, and make sure that everybody that comes in...
Well, that would have improved your relationship.
...prostrates. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, doctors don't walk on water, and you can just see him.
Oh,
his breath.
I do.
I thought, listen, if you're... We veered a lot, but I find orthopedists. I had knee surgery before...
There hardly are any women.
Yeah.
That's one of the little
things.
Do you want me to
try
to find out?
Oh, I'd love to.
Or
even
towards your friend.
Yeah.
I know somebody
who's
called.
Okay. I'll talk to
Sue. Exactly. Give a call. I don't know who you are.
Well, Diana Kamala, who's over in political science, and she's their fiscal HR officer over there, had Ray Kwasniewski, world-renowned Ray Kwasniewski, do her hip surgery. She said, the first time I went into an appointment, I came out of that appointment looking for somebody else. Now, she couldn't because he was such an arrogant, you know what. And she consequently had him done because she doesn't have him. I'm mouthy. I'm mouthy, and
but that's not a...
I thought, you know, Ray.
It's for his judgment I'm worried about, but he doesn't have any better sense than Judas.
Oh, he's just a jerk.
So, why do you think he has good judgment?
Well, because everybody says that Ray is the man. Ray is the man. He's world renowned, Margaret. Come on.
I can tell you why.
Anyway. Aside from all of that,
fall, winter.
Well, I was hoping to do it November, December.
Yeah,
that's good for us. Exactly. So I'm trying to, you know, really be there for everybody.
So sacrifice your Christmas. Pay the ultimate price.
And go with one of them. Okay. Yeah. Ray could be my Christmas present, couldn't he? I need to just kind of shift my thinking on this. Oh, I was so emotional for a day after that. I said,
"Yeah, you can't go through that." I really don't have to have that much
fear. I'm like, I don't care what you think of me. Just do my damn thing. I don't care. I'm not saying you're a bad doctor. I'm saying I don't like you. What's the whole problem?
Anyway, you're a jerk.
Anyway, we'll see. So, but if you have any, if you in your life, but I'll talk to Tom and Lou. I'm the person I know.
Right. You had to have a go. How would it be possible to find out the National Association of Boards, who are all the boards certified? And they're all the National Boards.
Okay. You know, make sure that you know about the meals, you know, and the limits on meals, because once again, Ohio State has come down on really recommended guidelines for spending.
We don't have lunch.
Okay. We have people that want to go to Hamby's, Red Queen's, Lawn Keep, you know, I mean, they really want to go to the top five.
This is sort of B-minus level catering.
So make sure you get the credit card, commercial credit card to use for your meals, and kind of guide you on what kind of stuff to buy for the conference, and with, you know, you'll need
so
to...
So who does the actual food buying stuff?
And that's always a good thing. People that want to be at the conference that are not core to it, you can always pull in some of those people. I mean, if you've got agendas and such, we could do some. We could probably have a student do some copying over here and put the stuff in the folder if you were to do the agenda itself. Because this stuff changes. I know agendas change from moment to moment. So. I just kind of, what I generally tend to do is just let you know, from my perspective anyway, you know, what are some of the logistical things that are that make a good conference
well,
program.
Well, we do need some advice about that. Yes.
And also, you know what's worked well for you in a conference, and we'll incorporate that. I mean, everybody has their ideas. I like them to just be seamless from top to bottom, so I'm a little nervous about them, and you know, because I just like people to come in and have things work really well without. You know,
focus on
business. Absolutely, you know, and then, you know, people get from point A to point B, and your memos that go out to your people about logistics are inclusive of all kinds of information, and they get confirmation numbers from the hotel. They know how they're getting from the hotel to here, back to there, back to somewhere, which is another thing you all need to think about. You know, how you're going to rent a van, you're going to, whatever you're going to do with Blackwell. Have some kind of van service. They do pick people up at the airport. Keep this in mind. But this, with 24 hours notice, yes. With 24 hours notice, they do it. If your people come in a group.
Yeah, I mean,
well, right, but are you going to? But what if it doubles the price of the ticket?
See, in order to get Columbus from Afghanistan, you have to stop somewhere.
I'm sure people do.
Both in Europe and in the U.S. Yeah. So if we make that stop Washington, D.C., then they can do some stuff. But there you have to come across with some money, which is $1 million.
Oh, yes, this will help with Washington.
Yeah, so with this one, there's a lot of things to be, obviously, much more complicated in a sense than anything else. And I haven't done visas, so check with Linda. I don't know what's involved in getting those. Okay. Okay.
But the African visas have several special requests for talking about the visas that we have.
Okay. Are you starting early enough?
I'm starting about 8 months into the graduate.
Yeah. Yeah, we're trying to be in a graduate postdoc. We've been trying to write early. So I'm here for advice. If I have time to give you more of me, I'd be, you know, more than happy to make sure to guide you on, you know, the way to set up the room and the lunches and you know, that kind of thing.
We already talked about the number of people that have probably 60 who want to have any tables.
Yeah, because what we usually, now this podium is needs to stay there.
Yeah.
But usually what we do is kind of a block U, or, you know, a block U that comes out from that angle, since that kind of is the focus of the room, and you can set people around that. And then once again, as we're talking about, well, this is
only 4 people at table.
Well, it depends on how you set them up. This is set up for 50.
Okay.
This is set up for 50, and then you can have your periphery people around the back. So this would be 10, you know, this is 10 tables of 5, and everybody can see this way. And then you can have, you'll want to have one table probably so you can have, if you want to have coffee or water inside the room, these tables stay outside so that when your lunches come in, those tables are outside, people can go out. And there may be more chairs in there. I think there's about 80 chairs all together. But you have to have a group
in the room.
Yeah.
So I think it'll work. I mean, I doubt the first meeting is really
you know, we could even, you know, move these up a little, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, they're
Rick likes to keep them back a little bit,
this is
I think.
Nice if you're doing the
if you,
yeah.
You know, rather than jam them up against there. But, you know, so you could have two more tables.
Well, at the last minute, too, if you needed more space.
Absolutely. I mean, you can put 3 on a side, but you really are kind of cozy.
Yeah.
Cozy. And then you're clumping. Absolutely. You know, and you can bring your stuff in, you know, that morning or, you know, whenever, you day before or something, if something's going on, you know, you can bring your supplies in. Once again, we supply nothing. It's your truck. Sugar packets to whatever. And I don't know if the Blackwell has a continental breakfast included or not. Have you booked with them?
No.
Because don't book with them, because I've got to do the paperwork on that.
Oh, okay. We're just finding the price.
Do you know what the rate is?
I don't know offhand. You had said, I think, 110.
The budget is for 110, but we don't know if they're still 110.
Now, the Hanson, you know, down across from the Civic Center, Convention Center, is 92. And they have a continental breakfast included. They don't pick people up at the airport. They don't have a van service. They bring people back and forth. Absolutely. But, you know, once again, the Hampton is a possibility. Like I said, there's a continental breakfast included. And if you go to dinner in that area, I don't. What are you thinking of doing for dinner?
We haven't really worked out. We basically look at the possibility of change of view or sometimes we don't think we're going to do this.
No. And we can have a group of, I think, 10 or 12 people for dinner.
Where would you think of it? Absolutely. That is a nice place inside. Very minimal, you know, but nice dark wood. This guy did. Today is the first time he used them, and he just brought me more. I mean, and the guy was absolutely perfectly on time.
I just couldn't.
Could go to a
place like Aliana.
Aliana? It's expensive, but it's close.
What about the first three-step Italian massage and the figure of the other?
you know, that's fine too. You just got to get them, you know.
And also in the short run, honey, this is where
lemongrass is good. Yeah.
Lemongrass is great.
And they have a private room. They have a private place where they can put you too, which sometimes is a
very and then I'm thinking of the Italian place in the
Strada is out of business.
No.
Yes, unfortunately, yes, and Tapatio is going out too. Absolutely, both of them. I have no idea. They did. I didn't hear, but Strada's out, and I'm just upset because we used them for a conference and they were wonderful and I'm upset.
No kidding.
Okay.
That's surprising.
They absolutely are moved to an. I don't have any idea. And I can't imagine the place would not exist in some. Yeah, absolutely. Great place. And see, when they were at the Hamptons, see, people, they had people that would.
Sure.
Just we would pick lemongrass and go to Strada.
Right across the street, what they would be doing.
Martini, you can go to Martini's. Very loud.
It's too noisy.
Very loud.
I stopped going there.
Yeah. Absolutely noisy. Haiku, if they want Japanese, I don't know if they, you know, that's a level two. Yeah.
So I was
there's nothing down here. Absolutely. Yeah.
We'll have to decide if we want to have outsiders come and deal with the mechanics and pay, whether each night is just going to be for Well, if we do allow people to register as registered participants and pay up front, then we can
Tell them
the rules and then we can do the event pay for it ahead. Then we can just pay.
You know, and just, you know, guidelines on that, make sure you get the credit card. You know, just stuff that makes a conference go round. But I think it's just my head. But this would what would be good when Melanie gets in the loop as well. And I have hotel lists and I've got I have all kinds of lists made up already.
I didn't think about it.
Well, we put a lot of people there. It's not a great aesthetically.
It's not bad.
It's fine. Yeah, it's just a little. I mean, but
it's new and it's clean and
it's so well located because if people have some downtime,
they can wander around.
Absolutely, they've got some place to go to see stores they haven't seen before.
Right.
Up here at the Blackwell, you're on campus. It's a great hotel.
Yeah,
absolutely. But
I built this one down there. What do Afghan eat there? Bread, feta cheese, jam, tea.
Yeah, and that's kind of what they're kind of. It's a continental breakfast. So, well, that's not. And what we've used for coffee, what has worked well the last two conferences I've done, is to get coffee from either Starbucks or Cup of Joe. They have these coffee travelers where you can get good coffee. Yeah, but I mean, they have these travelers. I think that whole 12 cups. But I mean, it's good coffee. And you buy a couple of those things, and they're $12 a piece. I mean, it's really great. Rather than getting some big coffee maker with crappy coffee that you have to clean out all night in traditional boxes. So,
tips on
that.
What about tea, though? They would be more like
this. More like tea. So we just need a hot water.
Yeah, and we have one.
And that
we have.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Sounds to me like. So I would suggest getting with Linda on some of your fiscal issues sooner than later.
I think she has
a class on Wednesday afternoons, but we can go up there certainly because I'll need to get the keys to your office. And then let Melanie, if you would pick a time when we all can meet again, perhaps as Melanie.
We're listening on in there today, so
okay.
We're using on.
Yeah, I leave at 4, and I'm in at 7:30 and out at 4.
Okay. It's possible that we will have Melanie working in our office.
Yeah.
So,
can we have 3 keys?
Yeah, I probably don't have 3 keys at the moment.
Okay.
I can always get 3 keys.
All right.
But I don't know what I have. And I may not have 2. I'm not. Okay.